This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode Charlie was pre-recorded back in early December to air on December 22, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Our usual numbered Macro Voices episodes bring you timely market information each week. We cover the topics of the day and strive to keep the content as fresh and up-to-date with current market events as possible. But on holiday weeks like this one, we have to skip our market wrap and bring you a pre-recorded episode, which unfortunately cannot take into account this week's market action.
And I'm Aaron Chan. We're actually going to bring you three timeless episodes this Christmas weekend. The recording you're listening to right now contains part three of Eric's Accredited Investor Academy series, which is basically a boot camp for accredited individual investors who seek to understand the world of alternative investments such as hedge funds and venture capital limited partnerships. Part three focuses on alternative investment funds, their legal structure and offering terms, fees they typically charge, and then continues with specific information about private equity and venture capital. We originally planned to discuss angel investing in part three, but David Rose gave us a fantastic interview on that subject back in Macro Voices episode 24, that we decided to repackage that interview as Accredited Investor Academy part 3A. That will air on our iTunes feed and at macrovoices.com on Friday, December 23rd. Finally, on December 24th, Christmas Eve, we'll have a special encore rebroadcast from our friends at Real Vision Television. We'll be airing part four, the final episode of the Accredited Investor Academy series, next week on December 29th. And then we'll have another special encore presentation from Real Vision for you on December 30th. AIA part three is coming up next. Happy holidays, everyone.
Hi, I'm Eric Townsend. Welcome to part three of our Accredited Investor Academy series. Before going any farther, I need to explain that we changed the format slightly from what was announced in parts one and two. Originally, we conceived part three to be all about private equity and venture capital, and then we planned to cover hedge funds in part four. But what we realized after part one and two were already recorded is that all of these alternative investment vehicles share in common the same legal structure based on limited partnership interests, and they also share in common similar fee structures, which are essential for investors to understand. So we're going to start part three by discussing the common traits of all of these alternative investment vehicles. Another change is that we originally intended to discuss angel investing based on my own knowledge of that subject. But since parts one and two were recorded, David Rose, one of the most famous angel investors in the world, gave us a fantastic in-depth interview on the subject of angel investing for one of our Macro Voices podcasts. So rather than try to do justice to that subject ourselves, we've repackaged that interview with David Rose as Accredited Investor Academy Part 3A, which is also available free of charge at macrovoices.com.
And I'm Aaron Chan, your co-host for this series. Eric, since we've changed the format, let's start by laying out the revised table of contents for the rest of Parts 3 and 4. What's next and what can listeners expect from here?
Well, we'll touch on angel investing, but only long enough to define what it is and who might be interested in it. Beyond that, we'll leave the in-depth discussion of the subject for David Rose in Part 3A, which is available on the Accredited Investor Academy page at macrovoices.com/AIA. From there, we're going to talk all about alternative investment vehicles in general, how they work, what their appeal is for accredited investors, the legal structure they all rely on, and very importantly, we're going to talk in detail about the fees they charge. So the lion's share of Part 3 is going to be about alternative investment vehicles in general, and will apply equally to private equity and hedge funds. Then the remainder of Part 3 will discuss the difference between venture capital and later stage private equity partnerships, how they work, and how they fit into an alternative investment portfolio. Part 4 will continue with a discussion of hedge funds and fund of funds, what they offer, how they work, and we're also going to add a section on managed futures and commodity trading advisors, also in Part 4.
Sounds great. Now, before we move on to alternative investment products such as venture capital, private equity limited partnerships, and hedge funds, what do we need to say about angel investing?
As we discussed in part one, alternative investments generally, including angel investing, are restricted by law in the United States and are only available to accredited investors. You can think of angel investing as the do-it-yourself side of the alternative investment universe. Everything else that we're going to talk about in part three and four involves hiring an investment manager to invest your money in private equity, hedge funds, managed commodity pools, or commodity trading advisor accounts. Angel investing means you as an individual accredited investor put up the seed capital needed to launch a new business. There are no middlemen or investment managers. You, the private angel investor, meet directly with aspiring entrepreneurs looking for money to launch their business. You figure out who has what it takes to succeed, and when you meet someone who impresses you enough that they really do have what it takes to succeed, you make a direct investment to fund the startup of their business, usually in the form of preferred stock or a convertible preferred note.
Well, that sounds pretty involved and obviously requires that the investor know a lot about startups in order to gauge which prospective entrepreneurs have what it takes to succeed. Now, what's the typical profile of a successful angel investor?
Almost universally, successful angel investors are themselves experienced entrepreneurs who have launched successful businesses on their own and know from experience exactly what it takes to be successful. They're also very comfortable with risk. Angel investments tend to go one way or the other. You invest in a startup and you generally either lose 100% of your investment or you win big if the company succeeds. So it's not for the faint of heart.
Okay, let's leave it there for angel investing. Part 3A of this series is basically a rerun of the Macro Voices podcast episode where you interviewed David Rose, the guy who literally wrote the book on angel investing. Now, after your interview with Mr. Rose, you and I discuss your own experience with angel investing and the surprising reasons why you decided after your first angel deal that angel investing just wasn't for you, even though the one angel investment you made was actually pretty lucrative. So listeners, you can find part 3A on the Accredited Investor Academy page at www.macrovoices.com/AIA. All right, let's move on to professionally managed alternative investment vehicles. Only accredited investors are allowed to invest in these things, but let's start with an obvious question. Why would an accredited investor even want to consider alternative investments instead of the, say, public stock market, which they're probably a lot more familiar with in the first place?
The primary motive is higher returns. The reason for investing in alternatives is if that you're diligent in choosing the right managers, you can expect higher investment returns than are typically possible in public equity markets while taking the same degree of risk.
All right, well, let's pause for a second here. One thing I'm almost always skeptical of, it's any claim about how some actively managed fund is going to, quote, beat the market, unquote. So Eric, you know as well as I do that there's a huge amount of academic research that basically concludes that active management doesn't work. Actively managed funds statistically underperform index funds over the long run. Now, this study only looked at managed mutual funds and ETFs, but can you speak to about whether or not these findings spill over to managers of alternative investments?
As you said yourself, Aaron, the studies that you're talking about all pertain to actively managed mutual funds or ETFs, which invest exclusively in public equity markets because they're restricted by law to investing in those markets. So when we're talking about alternative investments outperforming public markets, we're not talking about some mutual fund manager who says he's smarter than the next guy and can outperform another public market mutual fund thanks to his superior superhuman stock picking ability. We're talking about investment managers who either invest in private markets, which retail investors are prohibited by law from investing in, or in the case of hedge funds, we're talking about complex investment strategies that retail investors cannot invest in because they're, again, prohibited by law from doing so. Let's use an example, though, to illustrate the point. Suppose you owned a small business, such as, let's say, a barbershop. If you were to talk to a small business broker, you'd learn that at most, that business is probably worth about 2 to 3 times whatever it generates in annual profits. In other words, a price-earnings ratio of about 3 to 1. But the S&P 500 stock index trades at an average PE multiple in the 20s. So why is it that public companies traded on a stock exchange can fetch 20 times earnings or more, but your barbershop is only worth 3 times earnings? The answer is that when you bid on stocks in the public stock markets, you're competing with every other investor, pension fund, 401k plan, and other public investment vehicle ever created. But when you're bidding on a barbershop in a private acquisition transaction, the only competition for bids comes from other barbers in your local community. There's nowhere close to as much money chasing little companies like your barbershop as there is chasing big publicly traded companies. Now, stop and consider that for a second, because the very fact that private equity market valuations are lower because fewer buyers exist leads to an opportunity to arbitrage the difference between private and public equity market valuation norms. In fact, one of the most common private equity transactions is called a roll-up, and it takes advantage of the imbalance between public and private equity valuations. Here's how it works. Suppose that a late-stage venture capital fund manager notices that, let's say, public market valuations are particularly rich for, let's say, medical device manufacturers with $10 to $25 million in annual sales. Who knows why? It may be that microcap medical device companies are particularly favored because somebody famous wrote an article about them in a magazine read by institutional investors, or who knows what the issue is. But one way or another, there aren't enough of these small medical device manufacturers to meet the demand on the public market, so valuations are bid way up. What the venture capital fund will do is go out and find 10 privately held medical device companies that each only have $1 to $3 million in annual revenues. Now, little companies of that size are way too small to go public on their own, and the guys who own them know it. So these little companies are only worth, let's say, 4 or 5 times earnings, and everybody, including the owners of the company, knows that that's the reality of the situation. But medical device companies with more than $10 million in earnings are selling like hotcakes at 20-plus PE multiples because they can go public and take advantage of public market valuations. So the venture capital fund makes a deal to buy all 10 of those private companies as private acquisitions. And let's say they pay 8 times earnings to the private entrepreneurs who own them. The entrepreneurs are getting paid almost double what the going rate is for a company like theirs. So they don't hesitate to jump at the deal. The VC fund simply rolls them all together into a single company that has 10 different product lines representing the offerings of 10 acquired companies. The resulting company now has upwards of $20 million in annual sales. So the VC firm can do an IPO at a 20 or 25 price earnings multiple, and they've effectively doubled their investment just by rolling those private companies up and taking them out on the public market. Now, obviously, there's risks involved in that transaction. Some of the small companies being acquired could turn out to be frauds, or the market for public medical device companies could dry up before the IPO is completed. And of course, the VC fund has to figure out how to build a new management team from the entrepreneurs who are used to thinking of one another as competitors and sell that newly form management team to the market. But that's the business the VC guys are in. And for the ones who are really good at it and know how to manage these kinds of risks, they often make a killing on these roll-up deals. And roll-ups are just one tiny little example of a single type of transaction that exists in the alternative investment universe. The key to understanding it is that a much smaller group of investors, only accredited investors, are allowed to invest in the private equity market. And that creates a natural valuation differential that leads to opportunity.
Well, my too good to be true sensors are flashing bright red on what you just said. And when something sounds too good to be true, it almost always is. So what's the other side of the story here?
Oh, there's definitely another side to this story. The opportunity that I described with that roll-up is absolutely realistic, and it's just as lucrative as I described, if you can find it. But the hypothetical example that I just gave had a VC fund that finds this opportunity to roll up small companies acquired at 8 times earnings and then turn around and take them public at 25 times earnings. Now, it's true that incredible opportunities, just that lucrative, really do come along from time to time, but only once in a blue moon. And guess what? The very best venture capitalists are going to find those opportunities and scoop them up before the also-ran VCs even figure out that they were there. So this is a competitive sport, and the guys who are really good at it are kicking butt. But that doesn't mean that everyone running an alternative investment fund is doing that well. So here's how I want you to think about the universe of alternative investment managers. It includes 2 groups of money managers. Group number 1 consists of several hundred guys who really and truly have the ability to dramatically outperform the investment returns available through public markets on a risk-adjusted basis, and to do so consistently year after year, making a killing for their investors. Then we have group number two, which is about 8,000 guys masquerading as group number one people. They make their living on their sales acumen by duping unwitting investors into believing that they're investing in a group number one fund, when in reality, they're just con men with well-polished sales tactics, but very little in terms of skills at actually delivering outsized returns. Now, here's where it gets difficult. The guys that are clearly, obviously, and indisputably part of group number one, they get famous in a hurry. You know some of their names: George Soros, Stan Druckenmiller, Carl Icahn, Jim Rogers. They get so rich so fast that their services are quickly out of reach to all but a very few rich and very well-connected investors. Of the four famous guys that I just mentioned, all but one of them, Carl Icahn, long since retired from running other people's money, and now they just manage their own fortunes. They're literally so rich as a result of their consistent outperformance as fund managers that they're no longer interested in managing money for other people. Carl Icahn still runs outside money, but last I checked, he had a $5 million minimum investment level, and that was 10 years ago, so it's probably higher now. Now, you never want to put all your eggs in one basket. So assuming that you're going to diversify your alternative investments across several managers, you can't touch a $5 million minimum investment threshold unless you can allocate a bare minimum of $25 million to alternatives in general. So if you want to invest in alternatives and you have less than $100 million in personal net worth, the rockstar managers who are indisputably in group number one are going to be beyond your reach. You have to personally develop the skill to figure out which of the lesser known guys really are in group number one as up and comers versus which ones are con men from group number two. And the con men are pretty good at their game.
So in reality, there are opportunities that are only available to accredited investors, which produce dramatically outsized returns. And the managers who truly know what they're doing and have a proven track record quickly get filthy rich, because unlike public market fund managers, they get paid a share of the investment profits they make for their investors. But anytime anybody anywhere is getting filthy rich doing anything, it's likely to attract con men who are willing to do anything to get in on the game, regardless of whether they have the needed skills. So the guys who truly have what it takes, and everyone already knows who they are. They're like the prettiest girl in high school. Everyone wants to date them, so almost nobody gets to. So if you want to invest in these alternative vehicles and you're not already a billionaire yourself, you have to figure out who the lesser known guys are that actually know what they're doing and figure out how to distinguish them from the con men.
Bingo.
Okay, so how can you tell the con men from the truly capable alternative investment managers?
Well, the industry's answer to that question would probably be that you should place all of your trust in these middlemen called capital introduction brokers, who supposedly do the due diligence work for you and only show you safe and reliable managers. Pardon my cynicism, Aaron, but it was cap intro guys who made Bernie Madoff what he was. Madoff paid them higher commissions than other managers did, and they were happy to endorse him as the best of the best, when in reality he was just running a Ponzi scheme. My answer to that question: you have to personally invest the time and energy into learning about these alternative investment strategies yourself, personally, to the point that you're able to talk to a manager about what he does and figure out for yourself whether he's really on to something that will produce outsized returns, or if he's just another poser pretending he has skills that he doesn't.
Okay, got it. But something still doesn't quite add up here. You said that the whole problem is that the very best alternative managers are basically out of reach because they have super high minimum investment thresholds. Say a guy with a $20 million net worth who can only justify putting $2 or $3 million into a single investment can invest with the biggest and best known managers because the minimum investment of $5 million or more is still out of their reach. But even if you're a Ray Dalio or Carl Icahn or Kyle Bass or Jeff Gundlach or any of these big name fund managers who everybody knows to legitimately be part of what you called group one, the guys who really have a proven ability to consistently produce outsized returns, I mean, even if you're one of those big name guys, why wouldn't you be willing to take a $2 million investment from a private investor who only has $15 million net worth and can't justify more than that for a single investment? I mean, put another way, Eric, what's up with all these super high minimum investment levels?
It all goes back to the regulations, which frankly don't make a whole lot of sense. First of all, let's explain why these guys can't operate as traditional mutual funds or other regulated investment companies. SEC rules govern what mutual funds that are sold to the public are allowed to invest in. Private equity transactions like the roll-up example that we discussed earlier are off limits. So mutual fund and ETF managers are prohibited by law from investing in some of the things that fit in this alternative universe. But quite frankly, the real reason, the main reason, is that investments sold to the public as mutual funds and ETFs are not allowed to pay the manager a cut of the profits. And the guys who really have what it takes to consistently produce outsized returns, they want to be compensated for their skill in the form of getting a cut of the profits, usually 20%. But the rules don't allow that compensation scheme for funds that are sold to the general public. So the guys we're after aren't interested in running funds that are sold to the general public. So now the question becomes, under the securities laws of the United States, if the manager wants to be paid a cut of the profits, what are the legal ways to organize an investment fund that manages other people's money and still be allowed to pay yourself a percentage of the gains that were made by investing someone else's money? The answer to that is that there are just two very specific exemptions to the Investment Company Act of 1940 that allow an investment fund to both make investments that may not be suitable for retail investors and also to pay the manager a percentage of the profits earned by all investors. Those two exemptions are known as 3C1 and 3C7. The reason for the convoluted numbers is that they are references to the specific sections of the law that authorize these exemptions to the usual rules for investment companies, which is just the technical legal term for an investment fund.
All right, so in this case, the deal is that the investment manager wants to get a cut in on the percentage of everyone's profits, and there are only two exemptions a fund can operate under that allow those compensation terms. But still missing something here. My original question was why these guys insist on such high minimum investment levels. I mean, what does that have to do with specific exemptions to the Investment Company Act of 1940?
Well, what it has to do with is that both of those exemptions I mentioned stipulate a maximum number of investors that a fund is allowed to have. For the 3C1 exemption, the rules say that you can only have a maximum of 100 investors, and they all have to be accredited investors, as we defined that term in part one of this series.
Got it. So if I'm one of these group one fund managers and all due respect there, if I let a little fish like you into my fund with just a couple million bucks, then I just used up one of my investor quota, for lack of a better term, and I'm limited to a quota of only 100 investors.
Well, since you asked for a better term, in industry parlance, you would have used up a slot. And yes, you got the concept exactly right. A 3C1 fund can only be offered to accredited investors, and it only has 100 investor slots, where each slot represents one investor.
Okay, so you're saying that if you, Eric Townsend, an accredited investor, wanted to invest, say, $1 million into Carl Icahn's fund, in principle, Carl might actually want your investment, but he actually won't take it because it would use up this completely arbitrary thing called a slot. And if you're Carl Icahn and you only have so many slots, I mean, it makes sense you can get away with holding out for guys that can afford to invest upwards of $5 million in a single investment.
Precisely. You got it exactly right.
All right, well, what purpose does this concept of slots serve in terms of protecting the public or otherwise having any useful effect other than just making the very best funds out of reach to all but the wealthiest investors?
So far as I can figure out, none whatsoever. It's just what the rules say, and unfortunately, the rules force the most talented managers of 3C1 funds to restrict their money management services to the wealthiest 100 investors that they can find. They'd probably love to help more people, but the law says they can't. So the rules that are supposedly designed to protect smaller investors from the crooks are actually structured in a way that makes the very best money managers in the world, such as Ray Dalio, say, completely out of touch to almost any individual investor except for the filthy rich. The best and most lucrative investment opportunities truly are restricted so as to be only available to the rich. And it's U.S. securities laws, not the managers, that are imposing those restrictions. Your tax dollars at work.
Okay, so a 3C1 fund is one where the investors all have to be accredited, and there can only be a maximum of 100 investors by law. So Eric, please tell me that a 3C7 fund makes a little bit more sense and that the rules are actually designed to protect investors here.
Don't kid yourself. A 3C7 fund is allowed a maximum of 500 investors rather than 100. But being accredited is no longer good enough. In order to invest in a 3C7 fund, you have to be a qualified purchaser.
All right. Well, what's a qualified purchaser?
Well, it depends. If we're talking about an individual investor, you have to have a minimum of at least $5 million in investable assets to be a qualified purchaser. If we're talking about an institution, they have to have at least $25 million in assets in order to qualify.
All right, but something doesn't add up here. I mean, you're saying that a 3C7 fund can have five times as many investors as a 3C1 fund, you know, 500 to 100. But for individual investors, they have to have five times the net worth as well. The part I'm missing is why that even matters. I mean, how is it that a guy with more than $5 million in net worth should be able to invest in a fund that can have 500 total investors? But if the same guy with the same knowledge of investing and risk only has a $4 million net worth, he's only allowed to invest in funds that are restricted to 100 investors? I mean, if this is meant to protect someone from some sort of risk, I'm not really seeing the rationale for this 5-to-1 ratio in the rules.
Dude, you're trying to make sense out of government regulations by applying logic and reason. That's a losing battle. The rules are what they are. They don't make sense to anyone, so far as I can tell. But we live by them because that's the law of the land, and that's how it is. What you need to understand to make sense of this is that a manager who really does know how to outperform public markets has a choice to make. He can offer a 3C1 fund, and he'll be able to accept investments from anyone with at least $1 million of investable net worth, but he can only have a total of 100 investors, or 100 slots in industry parlance. His other option is to structure his fund under the 3C7 exemption. In that case, he's allowed 500 investor slots, but he can only accept investments from guys with at least $5 million in financial net worth as individuals, or $25 million in the case of institutions. As a general guideline, funds that are designed to appeal to high net worth individuals are usually structured as 3C1 offerings because there are a lot more guys with $1 million than there are with $5 million. Funds that are intended to be marketed primarily to institutions are generally structured under 3C7 because that allows them 500 slots, and almost all institutions meet the $25 million test. The very best of the best, the legendary names like Carl Icahn, Jeff Gundluck, Ray Dalio, they're generally running 3C7 funds. But even with 500 slots, they still have to worry about running out of slots. So they have huge investment minimums. They don't worry about the fact that 3C7 limits them to people with $5 million net worth because they don't want an investment from anyone who's not willing to invest upwards of $5 million in their fund alone. It's just not worth it to them to use up a slot for less than that level of investment. When you get to the really famous guys, the minimum investment levels are just out of sight. Suppose, for example, that you're really impressed with Ray Dalio and you want in on his flagship Optimal Portfolio product. Well, guess what? The minimum annual fee for that product is $4.75 million. Now, let me say that again. The minimum fee, not investment threshold, but the minimum fee that you pay annually is $4.75 million. If you back that out to figure out what the minimum investment is, assuming a 20% performance fee, that $4.75 million would be the performance fee on a $23 million profit. That's probably only realistic if you had at least a $100 million investment. So in effect, the minimum investment is about $100 million to be in Ray Dalio's Optimal Portfolio product. That's a really big investment. And the crazy part is that a guy like Ray Dalio would probably prefer to make his services available to hardworking people that are not filthy rich, but the law only allows him 500 slots, and he reasonably has no choice but to restrict those slots to the wealthiest 500 guys that he can attract.
So let's net this down for investors. If you're accredited and you can invest in a 3C1 fund, but the law limits the fund manager to 100 slots, so the manager is understandably going to estimate how much total capital he can raise, divide that by 100, and make that the minimum investment level. Now, the managers offering 3C7 funds are going to figure out how much they can raise and divide by 500 to determine the minimum, but they are restricted to only letting in qualified purchasers, which means north of $5 million net worth if we're talking about individuals. Well, now that we've covered the reasons for the huge minimum investment levels demanded by the best managers, let's move on to the fee structure they charge. Eric, can you explain more about this 2 and 20 phrase we hear a lot?
Alternative investment funds typically charge two fees, an annual management fee, which is a percentage of the total investment, plus a performance fee, which is the manager's cut of the profits. The exact percentages vary depending on how talented the manager is, how well known they are, and so forth. But the industry norm is an annual management fee equal to 2% of the total account balance, plus a performance fee equal to 20% of the annual profits earned. The phrase 2 and 20 is just industry slang for the 2% management fee and 20% performance fee. The same format is used with other fee structures. So, for example, a 1 in 20 fee structure means a 1% management fee and a 20% performance fee. A 2 in 15 structure would mean a 2% management fee and a 15% performance fee. Now, most newcomers to alternative investments fail to appreciate that that 2% figure is much bigger than it sounds, and the 20% figure is actually much smaller than it sounds. And the reason is that we're talking about percentages of two very different things. The 2% refers to 2% of the total investment. The 20% refers to 20% of the profits earned from that investment in a given year. So, for example, if the fund has a gross performance of 20% on the year, then 20% of that 20% is only going to be 4% of the total investment. But the 2% part is still 2% of the total investment. So even though the 20 in 2 and 20 sounds like it's 10 times bigger than the 2 in 2 and 20, the reality of the situation is that the 2 represents one-third of the total fees that would be charged in a given year if there was a hypothetical 20% gross return. Sophisticated investors in alternatives generally don't mind paying the 20% performance fee. They almost enjoy paying it. And the reason is that if you're investing with a legendary manager like, say, Stan Druckenmiller, who consistently delivered 40% plus gross annual returns, it's true that Stan is personally making a killing by pocketing 20% of the profits that he made by investing somebody else's money. But hey, if you're the investor, 80%, that's your share of the profits, of a 40% return, that's still 32% per year, year after year. And it's hard to complain about that. The 2%, on the other hand, gets charged regardless of whether the fund is up or down on the year. So suppose that the fund loses 4% on the year. There's no performance fee because there's no profit. But that 2% management fee literally increases the loss by 50%, from minus 4% to minus 6%. So for this reason, a recent trend in the industry is to pressure the managers to reduce the traditional 2% management fee, especially for larger accounts. The 20% incentive fee sounds like a much bigger number, but again, it's only significant when there's a large profit. And in that case, most reasonable people will agree that you want to let the manager keep their share of that large outsized profit that they delivered in that year.
Okay, well, now the 20% performance fee doesn't sound as bad. I mean, the manager only makes a killing if the investor makes a killing. And since the manager gets one-fifth of the profits and the investor gets four-fifths, that more or less aligns the interests of the manager and the investor. Now, if there's anything I've learned in my few years in this industry, it's that people do what's in their own best interest.
Well, hold on, because that's the sales pitch they want you to believe, but there's a very important gotcha that we need to talk about. It's true that the manager only makes money if the investor makes money, and in that sense, their interests are very much aligned, and you are exactly right. The investor should not invest unless their interests are aligned with the manager's. But the part they conveniently leave out of the sales pitch is if the fund loses money, that's the investor's loss. The manager doesn't lose anything. In fact, he still gets his 2% management fee, even if he loses 50% of your money in a single year. That creates a risk that's very important to understand, which is the manager, if he's not invested in his own fund, is going to have an incentive to take excessive risk with your money, because he wins huge if he makes big money for you, but he has nothing to lose if he loses big money for you. Now, there's anything but a healthy alignment of interests in that case.
Yeah, that's quite a lack of alignment of interest. But when you put it that way, suddenly this 2 in 20 thing is a little bit more suspect than it first seemed. So how can investors overcome this non-alignment of interest?
The single most important due diligence question to ask is what percentage of the manager's personal net worth is invested in his own fund. You want him to be strongly incented to make a big profit for you and for himself. And the 20% performance fee achieves that. But you also want him to have a very strong incentive not to take excessive or reckless risk with your money. The only way I know to guarantee that is if he has more to lose than you do. I would therefore never consider investing more money in an alternative investment vehicle than the manager has invested of his own personal money in this very same fund that I'm considering investing in. I want him to lose more than I do in a down year because that's the only way that he's going to be incented to work really hard to not let those down years happen. So what percentage of the manager's personal net worth is tied up in the fund is the first question to ask. If he tells you, well, that's personal information and not something that he's at liberty to discuss with you, run, do not walk as far as you can get from that investment. Everyone in this business who's credible understands that it is your business as the investor to ask such questions, and they won't hesitate to answer them. In industry parlance, the manager who is investing a significant percentage of his own personal net worth in his fund, that's known as eating your own cooking, meaning you're investing in your own fund. The fund manager who doesn't believe in himself enough to risk more of his own money than you're risking of yours, that's someone I would avoid like the plague.
So are any of these fees negotiable, or is the investor really stuck paying both the 2% management fee and the 20% performance fee every time?
The 2% is the more negotiable of those two figures, and it depends somewhat on the size of the fund overall. The rationale for the 2% is that it allows the fund to recover its overhead operating expenses. If the manager was just running his own money, he wouldn't need to pay for an office and a secretary and a third-party fund administrator to do the accounting or an auditor to audit the books every year. So it's perfectly reasonable for a small fund with, let's say, $10 million under management to demand this 2% fee. The 2% on a $10 million fund works out to $200,000, and they're going to spend that on overhead expenses, paying for their auditor, paying for their administrator, and so forth. But now let's consider the $10 billion fund. It still has a maximum of 500 investors, and the overhead expenses are going to be roughly proportionate to the number of investors. Is that fund really going to have an overhead expense of $200 million to keep its books? I don't think so. So obviously, your room to negotiate depends on how popular and in demand the fund is. If you only have a few slots left in the fund, the answer is going to be pay up or get lost. But if they still have plenty of slots, the 2% can and should be negotiated, particularly for large accounts. My own personal opinion, I would suggest that 2% of the first $1 million invested is reasonable. That's a $20,000 annual contribution to their overhead for using up one of their slots. And in my opinion, they should be happy to waive the 2% on any additional investment after that first million. But obviously, that's going to depend on how much demand exists for the fund in question. The performance fee is seldom negotiable, and frankly, you should let them keep their share. The fee is what incents them to work hard and to make that outsized profit for you. So they deserve their share of it when they produce an outsized return. But the most negotiable number is one that we haven't talked about yet. That's the minimum investment level. Yes, they have a fixed number of slots. That's true. But it's often possible to negotiate a lower investment if you also agree to something called an up or out clause. The idea is they've still got plenty of slots available, but they're going to run out someday. So they'll accept your investment well below their stated minimum on the condition that when they start to run out of slots, they can come back to you and say, Aaron, you gotta either pay up or get out. You have a choice at that point to either increase your investment to whatever their minimum is at that time, or take your money and go home and make your slot available for someone else who's able to come into the fund and meet their minimum investment requirement.
Okay, I think we've covered the fee structure concepts pretty well now. Eric, what other terms and conditions do investors need to understand relative to alternative investments?
The most important concept to understand is liquidity. For private equity vehicles, including venture capital, the deal is usually that you invest money up front and they keep it for several years before you ever see anything back. There's no option to redeem early. You can't just sell it at the click of a mouse the way you could a mutual fund or an ETF. So if there's any way out, it's going to be selling it at a very deep discount to another investor as a distressed sale. So you're locking up your money for a long time, sometimes as long as 10 years. For venture capital and private equity investments, that makes perfect sense. Those funds are investing in illiquid underlying investments, and they have no ability to let you redeem your interest early. You're being paid for this illiquidity in the form of larger annualized returns than you would likely see from public markets, taking the same degree of risk. 20% per year net of fees is typical for top quartile venture capital funds, for example. But you have to understand what you're getting yourself into. If you need that money back before the fund is ready to return it, you're going to be screwed. For hedge funds, managed futures, and CTAs, the liquidity restrictions are less demanding, but they're still there. It's not like a mutual fund or an ETF where you can just close out of the position at the click of a mouse. Depending on the nature of the underlying investments that the fund is investing in, hedge funds may have monthly, quarterly, or even annual liquidity. There's also typically a notice period where if you want out, you have to give them 40 days notice in advance. So this too is reasonable, especially if the fund invests in relatively illiquid underlying assets. They may need several weeks to liquidate assets in order to meet investor redemption requests. Most hedge funds have a one-year lockup clause, and that means that when you initially invest in the fund, you can't get your money back for a minimum of 1 year after your initial investment. This restriction is meant to prevent people from trading in and out of hedge funds like ETFs or stocks. They only want your investment if you're committed to staying in it for at least a year. And that the reason is that it would create unreasonable administrative burden for the fund if you were just trading in and out. But for the investor, what this means is you need to make sure you believe in that manager enough to tie your money up for a year at bare minimum. Not all hedge funds have lockups, but most do. Finally, something that you want to watch out for is what's known as a liquidity gate. It actually exists for good reason. The idea is that if a fund invests in relatively illiquid underlying assets, and suddenly all of the investors panic and demand redemptions all at the same time, the fund would be forced to fire sale its assets, and that could lead to an exaggerated loss for all of the investors. So to protect everyone against that scenario, if there is more than a certain percentage of investors that all request redemptions at the same time, the fund is allowed to temporarily suspend redemptions until it has time to liquidate the underlying assets in a controlled fashion. Now that sounds great, but what it really translates to is if things go badly wrong for the fund and everybody wants out, nobody gets out and everybody's money is locked up. So for this reason, I'd be very hesitant to invest in a fund with a liquidity gate in its offering memorandum.
Okay, before we move on to the particulars of venture capital and private equity limited partnerships, I have to ask a question. How come you don't hear more about these alternative investment vehicles in the media or in advertisements? I mean, especially if they can and do outperform public market alternatives.
Because alternative investment managers are prohibited by law from advertising or making public statements about their performance or the nature of the investments they make, except to investors who meet two criteria. First, the investor has to represent themselves to be accredited. Second, they have to ask for the information. So even if a fund manager has credible evidence that a particular individual is an accredited investor, they still can't send marketing material disclosing their fund's performance unless the recipient has first requested it.
Yeah, but didn't the Jobs Act that was passed a couple years ago change all of that?
Yes and no, mostly no. The passage of the Jobs Act did, in fact, open the door, allowing alternative investment funds to directly solicit investors, in other words, to advertise, without having to first satisfy the old system's two-part test of the investor representing themselves as being accredited and then requesting the material explicitly. But the way the law is written, if a fund uses direct solicitation, in other words, if it advertises, the burden of proof for determining whether or not the investor is accredited is shifted to the fund. Under the old rules, if the investor represented themselves to be accredited, that was good enough. You say you're accredited, I'll believe you. There was no hard evidence of accredited status required beyond the investor making that representation. But under direct solicitation rules, the burden of proof is shifted to the fund manager. And if the fund uses direct solicitation on just one investor, now the fund is required to be able to prove that each and every investor in the fund meets accredited investor requirements. In order to satisfy that burden of proof would require that the fund collect detailed financial statements from every single investor in the fund, and that's something most investors would never agree to do. So in practice, the Jobs Act is almost irrelevant. Most funds I'm aware of stick to the old rules, which still apply unless the fund opts to use direct solicitation, which again just means advertising. Under the old rules, you can advertise or disclose performance data only to accredited investors who have requested the information.
So it sounds like this is essential for accredited investors to understand that these funds cannot advertise or share performance data with them unless and until they ask for it explicitly.
Precisely. And it's amazing how few accredited individual investors realize what these rules say. The magic words that you need to learn are, I am an accredited investor. Please send me information about your fund. As soon as you say those magic words or communicate them in an email, an alternative investment manager can send you fully detailed information about their fund, what it invests in, what its performance to date has been, and so on and so forth. As the accredited investor, you have to know to ask. And unfortunately, many individuals who meet accredited guidelines have no idea that their accredited status qualifies them to request such information. Something else I've noticed, once they do figure this out, is that a lot of individuals will feel obligated to write to a fund and send some kind of resume saying, oh, I've invested for so many decades and I have so much experience and blah, 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 and so forth. Look, none of that matters. What they need to hear from you are two specific legal representations. I am an accredited investor. That's number one. Number two, you've got to explicitly request the information. Please send me detailed information about your fund. As long as you say those two things, they would love to send you all the information that they have. They can't send anything of substance until you make those two representations. And of course, in the case of a 3C7 fund, you would have to represent yourself as a qualified purchaser, not just an accredited investor. And then you have to request the information. Once those two legal tests are satisfied, they'll be delighted to send you full information.
Well, to be honest, it sounds a little absurd that you essentially need to first prove yourself worthy before finally receiving the marketing material. But from past experience of sharing that sort of material with our Macro Voices podcast listeners via the Research Roundup, I know that some of that material can actually prove to be quite valuable.
Oh, you're exactly right. It can be extremely valuable. In the case of private equity and venture capital, the pitch materials that you would receive, the sales materials, are likely to lay out where the offering firm sees the best opportunities in coming years. In the case of hedge funds, it's even better because hedge funds typically distribute a one-page monthly commentary known as a tear sheet that summarizes their monthly performance. That's the advertising part. But it also includes the manager's commentary on the opportunities that he sees in the markets. And it may even go into discussing in detail the trades that the fund has on. And in addition to the monthly tear sheet, many hedge fund managers also send out a quarterly letter to investors with much more in-depth perspective on the manager's views about the market and where he sees trading opportunities. So stop and consider this. How much money could you spend on subscriptions to market newsletters to get some supposed expert's commentary on where they think the market is headed? Now consider how likely that newsletter author is to be more qualified than a Kyle Bass or a Jeff Gundluck or some other heavyweight hedge fund manager. Accredited investors have a fantastic advantage over other investors, and most of them don't even realize it. They have the ability to send a one-line email to just about any hedge fund in the world, simply saying, I am an accredited investor. Please add me to your monthly tear sheet distribution. Sure enough, the tear sheet that they're going to start receiving is, in fact, a form of advertising, but it also usually contains monthly market commentary from the fund's manager. So it's like getting a subscription newsletter from that fund manager for free every month. Even if you have no interest in ever investing in the fund, the tear sheet is a free source of interesting information. And many of them contain very interesting market commentary written by some of the smartest and most successful investors on earth. So why not take advantage of that free subscription if you're eligible for it?
Agreed. So why don't we move on to specific alternative investments? We've already used up most of our time budget for part three, talking generically about alternative investments and their legal and fee structures. What exactly is venture capital, and how does it differ from private equity?
Actually, private equity is a broad term describing equity investments in everything other than publicly traded stock markets. Venture capital is a subset of private equity and refers to investments in relatively young private companies in order to fund their growth and expansion. So technically, venture capital is just a subcategory of private equity. But in terms of how the terminology is commonly used in practice, so-called private equity funds generally refer to later stage private equity as opposed to venture capital. That probably seems confusing, so let's just use a couple of examples to illustrate this. Suppose that a private company is going strong, it's already become profitable, but they have ambitious growth plans and they need to raise $50 million in order to fund the development of a completely new product line. Now, that's something that a mid to late stage venture capital fund might invest in. But suppose in another example that a big public company like Walmart wants to spin off its Canadian operations in order to raise money to make some major new investment in online retail to compete with Amazon, or who knows what their reason might be. Selling off the Canadian operations, finding the right buyer, or creating a new public company for the purpose of operating those Canadian Walmarts. That's the kind of thing that a so-called private equity fund managed by a private equity firm would typically take on. Technically, both of those transactions are forms of private equity, but when the transaction pertains to something that happens before a company's first public offering is made, it's usually referred to as venture capital rather than private equity.
Okay, so let's start with venture capital then. Presumably, this typically involves funding startups, correct?
Well, usually not, actually, and this is something that really took me by surprise when I got involved with investing in alternatives. As a former entrepreneur, I always thought of venture capital as the guys who invest in little startup companies like the one that I used to run, investing the money needed to get them off the ground and to achieve profitability so that they can sustain themselves. As it turns out, what I just described is known in the industry as seed stage venture capital. And frankly, most institutional investors don't like it because it involves too much risk associated with whether the company's business plan is actually viable or not. The lion's share of the venture capital business is focused on later stage transactions. For example, consider the company that already got the patent on their invention. They already sold 1 million units of it to the government or some other big buyer. They have the contract in hand, but they don't get paid until they deliver. And it's going to cost $50 million to manufacture those 1 million units that they already have a contract to sell. Venture capitalists love that kind of deal. There's no technology risk. There's no question whether the product is a good idea. There's no question whether there's going to be a market for it. It's already sold, and the buyer is willing and ready to pay up as soon as they receive their product. So the venture capital firm is happy to finance the manufacturing operations and get paid handsomely for enabling that transaction. Another example of late-stage venture capital is the roll-up transaction that we talked about earlier, where the venture capital fund sees an opportunity in a certain industry and combine several small private firms into a single larger firm that they can then take public on favorable terms.
Okay, so venture capital isn't just one singular thing. It's a lot of different things. Now, can I presume that there are numerous fund offerings that focus on different stages of the startup business lifecycle?
Exactly, and their offering terms will vary with the nature of the underlying investment. A seed stage venture fund that invests in brand new startups is probably going to be a closed-end fund where you make an investment and then you don't see your money again for 10 years. On the other hand, there are some later stage funds that engage in transactions that only last a few months, and some of those funds are offered with annual or even quarterly liquidity terms on an open-ended basis.
Well, if I wanted to invest in venture capital, how would I get started?
You'd start by learning the language of the business and understanding the various stages of growth that different funds invest in. For example, a Series A fund refers to an early stage venture capital vehicle that invests in startup companies that are not yet breaking even. This is usually the first professional money to invest in a company after angel investors provided the very first outside capital to get the company off the ground to the point of at least having some revenue, even if it wasn't profitable. The Series A fund invests to get the company to the point where it can break even on its operating expenses from revenue that the company generates. Sometimes this involves multiple rounds of financing. Once a startup company has made it to the point where it's profitable, it's still going to need more rounds of financing to fund its expansion and growth. But that kind of venture capital that's invested after the company becomes profitable is called mezzanine financing. There are lots of other terms to learn here. Wikipedia has an excellent article that's probably the best place to start learning more about venture capital. And from there, you can research who the most reputable VC firms and funds are. There are several databases of performance that are available on the internet that you can use to research available funds and management firms.
Great. Now let's move on to private equity funds. Eric, you said earlier that venture capital is all about the funding needs of small companies before they go public. So what do private equity funds do then?
The phrase private equity in the sense of a private equity fund generally refers to buying and selling entire companies or business units, as opposed to just funding the growth of a small private company. So that includes leveraged buyouts, where a company is acquired by a private equity firm using relatively little investment capital and the creation of a whole lot of new debt, usually in the junk bond market. It also includes buying and selling entire business units, spin-offs, mergers and acquisitions of entire companies by other companies, taking public companies private, merging them with other companies and taking them public again. All of these things generally are private equity transactions. And generally speaking, large institutional investors are more comfortable with private equity funds than venture capital funds, especially early stage venture capital funds. Betting on whether or not the latest software startup has found all of the secret sauce needed to propel the next, you know, big thing in the internet, that's generally considered way too speculative for the big institutional investors. So private equity tends to appeal more to institutional investors, whereas venture capital tends to appeal more to individual accredited investors, family offices, and smaller shops.
So where would an investor interested in private equity even begin? Is there a good place to learn about this kind of investing or a notable firm we can mention?
The household name of private equity firms is probably KKR, formerly Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts. They renamed themselves to just KKR. They were the pioneers of private equity limited partnerships. I think they actually invented the private equity limited partnership, and they pioneered the 2-in-20 fee structure, which has now become standard for private equity and for other alternative investments. They also pioneered the leveraged buyout transaction model, and they've offered several LBO-centric investments. Funds. Wikipedia has an excellent article on private equity, as well as a list of PE firms that offer investment funds to accredited investors. So there are also books available on investing in venture capital and private equity funds, but I'm afraid I can't recommend any from personal experience.
And I'm afraid we're just about out of time for part three. Before we close, what's coming up in part four?
The primary focus will be hedge funds. What are they? How did they come about more than 65 years ago? How do they work? And what advantages do they offer investors over public market investments? We'll also talk about managed commodity futures pools and commodity trading advisors. Finally, we'll discuss fund of funds, which are hedge funds that invest in other hedge funds.
And that concludes part three of our Accredited Investor Academy. Again, Part 3A offers a rerun of an in-depth interview about angel investing with one of the world's most famous angel investors, David S. Rose. Part 4 will discuss hedge funds, fund of funds, managed futures, and commodity trading advisors. All of these episodes are available free of charge on the Accredited Investor Academy page at www.macrovoices.com/AIA. Please join us again for Part 4. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Wishing all of you the very best in your personal journey as an accredited private investor.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and host, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.